Welcome, members and guests, to the December 9th meeting of City Club of Eugene. I'm Mary Layton, City Club President. Today's presenter is Dr. Pamela Weibel, who will talk to us about health care of, by, and for the people. The coordinator of today's program is Pat Skipper. Our sponsors today are Helios Resource Network, Network Charter School, Eugene Flower Home, and Dot Dotson's. A special thank you to KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space and free internet. Monique Carroll will introduce the program. Dr. Carroll is a pediatrician who earned her medical credentials in the Air Force, where she worked 4 years in a clinic on base. Since then, she has worked for Good Samaritan, where her practice included weekend call, and she now practices at the County Health Clinic on Charnelton, work that involves only daytime hours. Monique is a pediatrician, and she will introduce the speaker.
Hello. Thank you. I spoke with Dr. Weibel this weekend to prepare to introduce her for this talk, and she suggested framing my introduction by discussing my reason for becoming a physician and then what I see as my ideal medical home as well. So I became a physician after high school, where I was an athletic trainer and the de facto school nurse for a small Catholic high school. I quickly realized that I enjoyed helping people this way, and I was interested in what I was doing, and so attended osteopathic medical school, studying traditional medicine, and then also learning how to do spinal manipulation. I was trained in an Air Force residency and learned the pros and cons of essentially a universal healthcare system as an Air Force pediatrician. When I separated from the military, I worked as a private practice physician for 3 years, and currently I work at the community health centers of Lane County, Charnelton Clinics, about a block away. Our clinic is geared towards providing medical care for Medicaid, Medicare, and uninsured patients. We receive federal funding and grant monies in addition to the insured patients that we do see. I do outpatient care for children ages 0 to 18, 32 hours a week. I don't do inpatient or hospital care. And my current position is the best clinic I've been at yet because of the staff commitment to assist our patients and because I get the chance to spend more time with my two young children. My ideal model of healthcare is a clinic where I get adequate time to see my patients and to develop the important relationship with them. Much of healthcare, particularly preventative healthcare, depends upon understanding a family and then identifying those areas where they need help. And sometimes that's medical and sometimes it isn't. And that just takes time. My ideal model also offers the same health care to all patients, regardless of their ability to pay, their insurance, or their immigration status. Finally, my ideal model offers integration of the services in our community, so medical but also special education, mental health, subspecialty care, WIC, early intervention, housing services. So now I introduce Dr. Pamela Weibel. She's a family physician born into a family of physicians. She's a graduate of Wellesley College, the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, and the University of Arizona's Department of Family and Community Medicine. She's a dedicated physician who's found a calling to transform her profession, to improve the quality of life for patients and for physicians both. In 2005, she invited the citizens of Lane County to design an ideal medical clinic. She hosted town hall meetings, collected written testimony, and adopted 90% of the ideas presented when she opened her clinic later that year. So please welcome Dr. Pamela Weibel.
Thank you. It's really exciting to be able to actually speak in my hometown. I've been all over the country sharing what we've done here, and it's amazing to me that people in Eugene don't even know this, a lot of them. So I'm excited to celebrate the contributions that people, citizens in Eugene have made that are actually transforming the rest of the healthcare system in the country. So to start off, I would love to have people imagine for them what ideal healthcare is. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about health insurance. I think that, like, pretty much we have an obsession with how we're all going to get health insurance, but not a lot of time is spent on really what we want. Like, when we're sick and we go in to see a doctor, and how do we want the clinic to look and feel? And we never really get to that because we keep talking about who's going to pay for it. So I would love to just invite you to consider the notion, the idea of ideal health care. And if you could have anything, what would that be? So how many of you remember house calls when you were little? Wow, so wasn't that great? And does anyone remember when doctor's appointments were less than $5? Does anyone remember that? It actually happened because I looked through my dad's, my dad was a general practice doctor, and I looked through, he saves everything, so he has, even from the 50s and 60s, like day by day, all the patients' names written in pencil, and yeah, $3, $2, $5, you know, doctor's appointments were really less than your current copay. And so 50 years ago, before Medicare, people generally paid about $3 to $5 for their office visit, and seniors got a discount just naturally. You know, doctors would give seniors a discount. You know, maybe they'd pay $1 or $2 per office visit. And back then, I know this is kind of hard to believe, but doctors did not need any staff. Like, they were sort of like a one woman, one man show. Like, you didn't need a billing department, you didn't need, you know, a receptionist, you didn't really, and they didn't even have cell phones then. I mean, it's kind of amazing. They did all that without computers or anything. And then my dad actually had all of his medical records on, like, little index cards in a little file on his desk. It was just like a recipe box, I guess. And I guess he would flip through it. So that's how he did medical records. And back then, doctors actually knew you and your entire family since birth, probably. And they actually looked at you and not computer screens. So, you know, maybe that was ideal health care. Maybe. Or maybe ideal health care, just throwing out some ideas, you know, since we're in Eugene, maybe ideal health care is a healing center with yoga, an organic garden, with a maybe gluten-free cafe with a juice bar, where you can go and meet up with your doctor and your acupuncturist and your life coach over, you know, quinoa coconut curry, you know. I mean, that could be ideal. I mean, the ideal is really whatever works for you. So continue to think about that. What would that be for you? Because the reality is the government cannot deliver that. Ideal health care is defined and designed by communities. And there's actually a national movement now where patients are coming together with physicians and other healthcare providers, and they're actually taking the lead and designing their own ideal hospitals and clinics. And this all began with the citizens in Eugene. So I'm really very proud to be living here and to have such creative, thoughtful, civic-minded people. And so how this worked is, you know, in 2005, I was tired of assembly line medicine. And so I left and decided to put my patients in charge. I thought, well, since I'm not happy, my patients aren't happy, what if we just got together and I asked them what they want? You know, I held town hall meetings throughout Lane County, 9 over a period of 6 weeks, and collected, like Monique said, about 100 pages of written testimony, and was able to adopt the majority of that, about 90%, and we were open 1 month later. I mean, it's kind of amazing if you think of how many decades they can talk about this in Washington, D.C., where you could just go, like, to your neighbor's house and knock on the door and be like, what do you want? I want to be your doctor. And if they tell you and you do it, you pretty much are way ahead of what they could deliver to you from the centralized government. So now what's exciting is that my job description, which I brought here, this is actually the testimony. And some of it's in their packets there. And this is my job description has been written by my patients and not administrators. So that's very refreshing for me because I actually get to provide the type of care that my patients want. And so it's very simple when you look at it. All I basically did was ask patients what they want and deliver it. And it's a pretty simple two-step model. And so I would just like to share some of what the community members actually said that they want. And this is in their own words. For example, Mimi Delfiner, a stay-at-home mom, describes a sanctuary, a safe place, a place of wisdom, a place where we learn to live harmlessly, listen with empathy, and observe without judgment. A place where a revolution starts, a new way of seeing, where we rediscover our priorities. And politicians can't legislate that, because real healthcare reform isn't from the top down. It's from the inside out and the bottom up. And Lynette Chang, you might know some of these people. She's in Peru now, but Lynette, I don't know. Does anyone know Lynette? She's a Chinese woman with an Australian accent, a biker. I wish I could say this in her accent. It's really cool, but I can't, and if I try, it'll sound stupid. But Lynette Chang says, an ideal clinic has no high front counters separating people from people, a lounge of sorts, sofas, not hard chairs, and no old magazines that make you think of your own mortality or how many years have passed. Music that is comforting but not schmaltzy. Rooms set up in some rustic, homey theme with fun surgical gowns and complimentary massage while waiting. So it really wasn't hard to do any of that. You know, I got a sofa. It was like a futon. I got another sofa. Then I have a beanbag love seat from that guy, Rob, that makes those cool beanbags in town. It's all plush and nice. And then I got flannel gowns that were made by my neighbor. And then I got a woman to massage anxious patients during their appointments. So it was like, wow, that was pretty easy. A cool idea. Lynette, she's just got great, great wisdom. And then a woman named Anita Stelling, she's a retired medical social worker, and I haven't even seen her since this meeting, nearly 7 years ago. She states that an ideal doctor treats you as a peer and not a commodity. In a place where time and money do not seem the most important things. Anita wants to sit in a comfortable room with overstuffed chairs, with a holistic practitioner who has naturopathic and allopathic abilities, removing the either-or idea, and eliminate the medical assistant who weighs and measures and takes notes that the physician doesn't read anyway. So there's actually a word for what Anita is requesting, and it's called disintermediation. Does anyone know what that term means? Disintermediation, oh, you've got to write it down. It's really good. D-I-S-I-N-T-E-R, mediation, M-E-D-I-A-T-I-O-N. It means removing the middleman. Wouldn't life be great if we did that? Because what that does when you remove the middleman, which could be like, you know, basically all the administrators and people running around in circles that make you anxious when you're a doctor and you just want to spend time with your patient, but you keep getting interrupted by everything. So it's removing, you know, even maybe insurance companies and things like that. You remove the middleman so people can actually have direct relationships with their physicians again, because that's what was going on in the 19, before Medicare. Before Medicare, people had direct relationships with their physicians because there wasn't any third party. And so what patients really want is they want to trade these big box clinics with phone trees and cafeteria style waiting rooms for a family doctor down the street. As David Klossman, right here, wave to everyone. David Klossman, a computer consultant, explains that the doctor should be self-employed or work in a small clinic, doctor-owned. So I just pretty much took all the material, like these four pieces of testimony, and kind of blended it up together and added my little few spices in and came up with this clinic. And basically in April 2005, I opened a small doctor-owned, community-designed clinic that features, it was in the South Hills of Eugene at the Tamarack Building, which now features yoga and massage and midwifery. We've got community gardening and counseling and chiropractic care. Lal is here. Where's Lal? We've got our chiropractor here. And then also we have this this beautiful saltwater, solar-heated, wheelchair-accessible Tamarack pool, which is very unique in the state. And it's just a beautiful location for a clinic. And what people can do now is they come to the clinic and they can relax in like a jacuzzi instead of a waiting room. And then they can walk down this little covered path that leads to the doctor's office, which is set up kind of like a living room. So you're in a warm, cozy, small living room sort of a place where you get 30 to 60 minute appointments. And these are same-day appointments, and even on the weekends, I'll go when anyone needs me, and even house calls. So all of that. And then if I have a guarantee that I'm always going to be on time, and if I'm not on time, patients get a gift. I have a gift basket by the door. So if I'm more than 10 minutes late, people get a gift. And sometimes if I'm 9 minutes late, I wait an extra minute just because it's fun to give people gifts. I've done that with Belle, I think. And then, and I admitted it to her, you know. And so then there's also prizes for meeting health goals, you know. So instead of making people sort of feel bad that they keep smoking, you know, it's better to just give them a prize when they quit. You know, that's kind of one of the, I'm trying to use positive methods here. And so people who bike to the office, for example, they get to pick a gift from the gift basket, you know, because they exercised, and I want to, you know, I appreciate that people are taking time to build that into their life. And so in the clinic, I accept most insurance. Oh, and there's no extra fee, by the way. This isn't like one of those things you have to pay an extra fee. Sometimes I call it like it's VIP without the fee, something like that. And I do accept uninsured patients. I have a lot of uninsured patients. And what they do is they can trade or barter by placing maybe their products or services in the gift basket as a donation to other patients. Because I don't really need a lot of organic children's clothing. I didn't have any kids. And I don't, you know, need a lot of wooden bowls. But there's really cool stuff that these artisans make in Eugene at Saturday Market. And so I like to be able to accept what they make and then maybe pass that on to somebody else who quit smoking and needs to have, you know, something like soap from Friday at the farm to get that smell off their clothes. And so anyway, nobody is turned away for lack of money. You know, that's how I can sleep at night. I feel like I'm living the ideal that the community, in alignment with the community vision, but also an ideal for me, is that I never turn anyone away. And so how, without grants, loans, and staff, could an ideal clinic possibly exist? People get a little confused by this because it's way out of the box. But then Eugene people are sort of out of the box people, so I think you can grasp it. It basically, the key is, in one word, relationships. You know, it's relationships with patients like Rob Bowman, who wrote that the doctor should know patients in a social context, you know, kind of how it used to be. So like one afternoon, I was renewing my driver's license, and Rob called me about his finger, an injury he had. And so I'm not trying to sit there and think, who's Rob? I wonder who Rob is. I just pretty much say, hey, meet me at the DMV, because I knew he lived right around the corner. I mean, it's closer for him to meet me at the DMV than go to South Eugene. So he came to West 11th. I treated his finger. I renewed my license, treated his finger. He transferred a car title. He just happened to have some work to do there, too. And then he passed me $50. And we did that all in less than 30 minutes, which is quicker than you can be seen in any ER in town. So, like, that's ideal healthcare, right? And then it's relationships with consultants, because Amanda Duquette, a speech therapist in town who no longer lives here, she's in D.C., but she came to the town hall meetings, and she says, a speech therapist, I love that she's the one that said this, communication, direct talking, not notes among professionals and specialists with the same patient. So now I actually accompany patients to specialist appointments. And it's relationships with staff, like Kathy. One day I was seeing an OHP patient who needed an urgent cardiology referral, and due to her abuse history, she wouldn't see a man, and like all the cardiologists in town are men except for one. And so it was going to be a problem. So I, instead of faxing her referral to the OHP office, I rode my bike there. And then I asked the woman who met me at the front to take me to the fax machine. And then we stood there for a while, and I asked her, you know, well, now where would I go? And then she took me to Kathy's cubicle. And where I went to Kathy's cubicle, I leaned over and I asked, well, how do you know if I'm approved? Well, that woman was blown away that I showed up, because doctors, I mean, she was bored in her cubicle all day. And I showed up, and I'm Dr. Weibel. I'm a human fax, you know. And she got really excited. And so she clicked her mouse three times and told me, she promised me my referrals would always be approved forever. Isn't that great? It was so much better than a fax. So that's the value of a human fax. You know, when they talk about technology will solve healthcare, just remember that story. Okay, and relationships with community. So, you know, traveling around Lane County, meeting face-to-face with Oregonians, I discovered what citizens really want, and what they want is community-supported medicine. So it's kind of like community-supported agriculture. You know, Gary Delfiner explains, an ideal clinic would be locally, publicly funded, and most people only need minimal day-to-day care, and catastrophic could be the actual national healthcare system. And people really want to financially support their family doctors rather than insurance companies anyway. And if doctors reciprocate by actually listening to the community and aligning themselves with what people really want, then community members are willing to do anything. Like, they'll answer your phones and volunteer to clean the toilet. And I mean, they'll do anything. And they, even one doctor I know got a $50,000 check from a community member who was so inspired by this. And so literally, that is community-supported medicine. And so I got to go fast because I think I'm running out of time. How much time do I have? 3 minutes. Okay. This is good. Now, one word about Medicare. I have one word for Medicare. Divisive. Medicare pits Republicans against Democrats, specialists against primary care physicians due to their unequal payment structure, and physicians against their very own patients. Okay? And so how this works is like, see, patients, from a patient's perspective, it's great because Medicare is like an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's really good from a patient's perspective. And then they get your votes, you know, because they give you what you want. However, it doesn't work great for physicians who are basically treated like the waitress. They're paid like less than a waitress salary. Okay? Less than minimum wage is what physicians get from Medicare. Okay? And so that, and not only that, they're also treated like criminals. They assume that you're a criminal. You have unfunded administrative hurdles that you have to jump through, like an insane amount of these. And then you have constant threats of fraud investigation, which will send you to jail if you break any rules. So you have to constantly worry, will I be sent to jail? Their rules for Medicare are like this thick. Like, even people that work at Medicare can't agree on the right code for a hospitalized patient. Only 1 in 4 ever agree. You know, I mean, it's just, it's insane. And then there's constant threats of pay cuts. Like, I just opened up, I got this the other day, the Family Practice News, and here, this is a headline story, holiday humbug, docs get 27% pay cut. Isn't that great? Every year I've been reading this, year after year, we get pay cuts. And so, and it's just bizarre because, you know, already, back in 2008, 36% of doctors lost money every time they saw a Medicare patient. They went in the hole. And with Medicaid, it's worse, like 65%. And one guy, actually, a doctor told me recently, he's been getting checks from Medicare for 3 cents. That's like 10 times less than the value of the stamp on the envelope. If you ever want to feel undervalued as a physician, just think about that you're getting paid 3 cents and you're going to get a 27% pay cut, which will, after you pay overhead, you might have a penny. I mean, it's very strange. And patients don't realize this because doctors don't often reveal the painful truth about being a doctor. And so who in here believes doctors are rich and greedy? It's okay. Does anyone here think doctors are just like rich and greedy two people? Okay. You know, honestly, you know, doctors are humanitarians that just want to help people, and they get beaten down by, you know, these bizarre things that happen in medical school, and then it just gets worse when you take an assembly line job, and then you have to deal with all this Medicare. It's just insane. And so, but when you ask, oh, I even in 2004 quit medicine to go back to waitressing. You know, I mean, I might as well, you know, go to jail, get paid better, you know. It's really, but when you ask in a survey physicians, when you ask them what their greatest source of professional satisfaction is, 61% say it's the patient-physician relationship, and 21% say academic stimulation. So they're not in it for the money; they're in it because they want to take care of you. And then, for some reason, you know, if you want to see a doctor cry, ask him to pick between two choices. One is close your office. Or take care of grandma, you know, and that's what Medicare does. And so in the ideal world, doctors would make more than minimum wage, and we'd never send patients to collections. And doctors like me now are getting tips, which is bizarre. Patients are paying me more than I asked for. For example, this patient, Kevin, came in, and he wanted me to surgically remove a little lump on his arm. Turns out it was next to his ulnar nerve, so I couldn't really do it. I pretty much talked him out of it. I said I didn't want to paralyze his arm. Well, this guy, after 10 minutes of just sitting with me, I didn't really do anything. I said, I don't really know what to charge you because I didn't do anything. He stood up, and he emptied his pockets and gave me $87.23. So I think he paid me for being human. And, you know, just to summarize, there's four things that I learned in the last 6 years that I think are worth repeating, is that healthcare is really about relationships and not about politics. And what people really want is very inexpensive and simple. And patients are way smarter than experts and politicians and practice consultants, and they're a lot cheaper. And then what's really interesting is I've attracted a lot of Republican men that think this is very fascinating. They love this. They've hired me to try to replicate this in other towns, even at the level of hospitals. And so I just want to thank, first of all, if you could stand, the people who came to the town hall meetings. If you're here today, I just would like to recognize you for your contribution 7 years ago or so, for coming to these meetings and actually giving your input. Thank you. It couldn't have happened without you. And then just in closing, I would like to share the impact that you had by reading a little paragraph from Optimism. And, you know, what you've done is you've inspired people to replicate this model all around the country. And I would like to just share a story about Mariah Emeny, who's a doctor in New York State. And she was burdened with $273,000 of student loans while single parenting a daughter with cerebral palsy. And all she wanted to do was get off the hamster wheel and, you know, she dreamed of being a country doc. And she called me up and asked, you know, what should I do? I have doctors calling all the time that just want to quit medicine. And I basically tell them, go sit down with your community and ask them what they want and share your dream and do it together. And what do you know? She had a town hall meeting with the citizens in Westerlo, New York. And then her dream came true. Townspeople raised $2,500 with bake sales, spaghetti dinners, ice cream socials. They sewed gowns and blankets and donated a washer, a dryer, snow tires for her car, remodeled an apartment for her family, and then they posted Doc Mariah's healthcare center on a building that she pays $1 per year to lease. And patients volunteer to do billing and office work, and one is teaching her horseback riding. And despite all these oppressive regulations and layers of bureaucracy, Doc Mariah keeps smiling as strangers snowplow her driveway and patients arrive with her favorite triple chocolate cake. And in summary, what's important, Mariah says, is believing this is possible, because most people give up on dreams like this. Thank you.
Our first questioner is Debbie Farr. Debbie is the Director of Marketing and Community Relations at Mackenzie Willamette Medical Center, where she has worked since 2007. We've probably seen Debbie around in various other jobs that she's had, Healthy Woman and Senior Circle. She was a speech and theater major, so she performs on stage. She used to be a representative, and she continues her community service as chair of Bethel School Board and as a member of United Way's Success by Six leadership team. Debbie?
Well, you present a model of healthcare that I think all of us would really enjoy. I know that when I'm waiting to see my gynecologist, I would much rather be in the hot tub than the waiting room. So I want to give just a little background before I ask my question. Medical school tuition and expenses generally range from $140,000 to $200,000 per year. And young doctors who graduate from medical school, in fact, who graduated last year, had an average debt of $158,000. Almost one-third of the students owed more than $200,000, with payback periods of 25 to 30 years. Contrast that with the average income of a primary care physician, who usually earns $120,000 to $190,000 a year, compared with $530,000 and higher for those in specialties such as neurosurgery. Currently, the medical system has about 100,000 family physicians and will need more than $139,000 in 10 years. The current environment is attracting only half the number needed to meet the demand. A shortage of 40,000 family physicians is predicted by 2020, when the demand, due to 78 million baby boomers who begin to turn 65 in 2011, is expected to spike. So spending more time with our physician is something I know all of us wish for. I coordinate a women's wellness program at Mackenzie Willamette called Healthy Woman. And one of the things we do in that program is we have monthly events where we have a physician present on a specific health topic. And we have a Q&A session that's incredibly popular because women have lots of time to ask this physician questions and get answers in a very informal and relaxed atmosphere. So my question's for you. My question is actually a two-part question. How does this ideal clinic model work for these physicians who need to earn enough to pay back their student loans and provide income for their family? And how can this clinic model, when seeing fewer patients with longer appointments, meet the huge demand for patient care that the country will soon experience?
Thank you for your question. That I knew I was going to get that question, so The doctor shortage question comes up quite a bit, and I'd like to just say, you know, we live in a country where we lose a doctor a day to suicide, and 60% of doctors want to quit. So what we have in the United States is a shortage of doctors willing to be abused. And that's what we have when you get down to it. And so when you have these people fleeing the profession, what politicians and I think other people tend to think is, well, let's just build more medical schools and try to push more people into this. And so, but increasing medical school enrollment is not going to stop the exodus when you put doctors in an inhumane job in an impossible situation. And these are basically caring, altruistic people who are beaten up. So, you know, also turning doctors into technicians practicing cookbook medicine and 7-minute visits isn't working too well either. So, like, what I basically am suggesting, which is not coming from me, again, all of this is just coming from amassing the community vision, and the community vision is that we need to restore the patient-physician relationship. Because when you think about it, you know, that's what you want. When you go to the doctor, you really want that attention. You want them to be there for you emotionally, physically, and spiritually present. And doctors, 61% of them, that's why they went into medicine, to be there for the patient in that relationship. And when you do that, what happens is you don't have 60% of doctors quitting. I have doctors all the time who are calling me, and I just barely save them by, you know, turning them onto this new idea. And so we would actually restore and replenish our workforce if we allowed doctors to practice medicine humanely. And we would bring back all the, my mom is sitting right here, and she's a retired psychiatrist. She's bored out of her mind. She wishes she could work. And the thing is, there are so many bored retired doctors that would love to go back to work, but they're not going to submit to 30 patients a day and being treated like a kindergartner by administrators who, you know, really, I mean, it's just ridiculous. We need to honor our healers. They wanted to be healers. We need to honor them as healers. And I think when we do that, we'll really have people naturally want to go into family medicine. In fact, my first year in this ideal practice model, 3 of my patients decided to go to medical school and become physicians because they were so impressed seeing what a real physician could really do. And I never had anyone on an assembly line model say, wow, it looks like you're having fun. I think I'll go to medical school. Nobody ever did that. So I think that another piece of this doctor shortage issue I want to mention is that it's not just the fact that when you look at the whole healthcare system, it's built on this doctor-patient relationship. And if the doctor is more wounded than the patient, well, no wonder the thing is collapsing, you know? And so that's the actual, to me, the very first thing you would need to do if you wanted to fix the healthcare system is actually heal the doctor, heal the healer who has been, basically their soul has been killed through their training, and they continue to be abused in many of these impossible corporate jobs. Okay. And so then also realize if you team up with the community and patients, that will ease your workload. Like listening to what citizens want. Citizens want doctors to share their workload with other healing arts professionals, like massage therapists and acupuncturists and Reiki masters and, you know, and naturopaths. And the thing is, most of these people are certified by the state and underutilized because they're not included in the fold, you know, in the medical fold. So if we actually decided to share there's many different forms of healing, and I think if we share the work with the people that would like to be involved, we'd have more than enough hands to help. And the other thing is that having an ideal clinic model, which is not necessarily just what I've described, but it's defined by the community. Having this model will put patients in a place of responsibility. Right now, patients feel dependent and sort of dumbed down, and they would be more compliant and self-reliant if they felt like they could have an hour with their physician instead of like 10 6-minute visits over a year. And so it's just, I think you'd have less overutilization. As far as the money is concerned, you can actually earn more money working this way. I can earn a full-time salary working part-time because I cut out the whole middle layer. This disintermediation piece really eats up a lot of money. So it works. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was... Now, at your table conversations, it's your turn to come up with some questions for the good doctor.
You are tuned to KLCC Eugene, 89.7, 90.5 KLCO Newport, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, and on the web at klcc.org.
Program on healthcare of, by, and for the people. Our special guest today is Dr. Pamela Weibel, and now it's time for questions from our members.
I'm Joe Von Hippel, a City Club member since 2001. Vermonters are very independent people. They have their own. They ran their own state with town hall settings, just like you did, for a long, long time. One Sunday evening, I went on a house call with a Vermont physician, and we went to a family farm to see a patient who had pneumonia. She was paid with gourds. The Vermonters are coming here next Friday. They are coming to Harris Hall at from 7 to 9 next Friday, December 15th. Okay, December 15th at Harris Hall, the Vermonters will come here to tell us how they campaign for single health care. If we had single health care in Oregon, we could practice the way you do. What do you think of that?
Thank you for the question. So the question is about single payer and whether that would allow physicians to practice in the style that I'm speaking of. And actually, it just really depends, because this whole idea of Medicare for all, which is single payer, I think I addressed why that really doesn't work for physicians. And so it would take a lot of creativity to make it a palatable system for physicians, because actually a recent study that was put out by the Physicians Foundation Survey in 2010 reported that that 60% of physicians actually plan to limit their practice to accepting new Medicare and Medicaid patients once health care reform kicks in, because they can't possibly take, you know, the volume. And then also they feel that their quality of care, the majority of physicians feel their quality of care will go down, you know, due to some of those factors I brought up earlier. And in response to this is really just
very sad. 40% of physicians said that they would drop out of patient care in the next 1 to 3 years if healthcare reform went through. And so the thing is, I think, again, you sort of have to look at this from outside of your perspective. As a patient, you know, single payer sounds great. Medicare for all sounds great. But for a doctor, you're treated as a criminal and you're paid less than a waitress. So I think that's really the thing that we need to focus on is how are we actually going to practice in a way or create a system that honors our healers and doesn't abuse them. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joan Obie. I'm a new member. You had said you have to limit Medicare patients, and everybody is. So if we turn to a system like this, which sounds grand, what happens to our Medicare patients? Because they're often the ones that need us the most, you know.
So the question is, what would happen to Medicare patients if, you know, we, like, for example, in my clinic, what happens to Medicare patients if I don't accept Medicare as an insurance? And I have to just be totally honest and say, I don't turn anyone away for lack of money. I still see Medicare patients. I just don't accept Medicare as an insurance. You know, honestly, I would rather see Medicare patients for free than deal with Medicare. So I don't turn anyone away. In fact, what's really interesting, I find, is when I'm actually seeing somebody and not charging them and not thinking about any of that, I have a lot more fun. You know, I'm actually enjoying being a doctor more when I'm not thinking about all those other people that are unnecessarily involved. And I think the patient gets a lot more out of it as well. So I think what would happen is we'd probably go back to how it was before Medicare. Like I said, when there were house calls and visits were like a reasonable fee, and basically doctors on their own volition, you know, with their own, you know, they voluntarily decreased their fees by 50% for Medicare patients and let people slide. I mean, doctors didn't turn people away back then. They took care of everyone in the town. And so I think we'd go back to a much more sane, humanistic model. I hope that answered the question. So Medicare patients aren't left out in the cold, at least in the model that I would suggest.
Well, we had a nice, crisp, concise question, but then the previous two questions have rendered it a little bit sloppy. I feel that my biggest pet peeve is that every civilized country on earth has a single-payer national health care system. They all provide health care to all their people at 40 to 50% less than what we pay here. And I think the United States is really stupid not to be doing what they do in Canada, Europe, Japan, Australia. And I don't doubt that any of those systems are perfect, but I'd rather they be whether we be approximately right rather than exactly wrong. So my question is how to on one hand, there's this idea that we ought to have a national health care system, and there's a whole question of how Medicare, you know, is not so good from the standpoint of the physicians and so forth. But how would you reconcile between this ideal on one hand and then the decentralized, more community-based system that you're proposing on the other hand? In other words, they talk about states providing a health care system like Massachusetts is said to have done, I believe. And then what about just doing it on the community level? Like Eugene has two big major hospitals here. Why not just have our own little Eugene healthcare system, which would, in a sense, be run by the people? And then, Michelle, did I adequately address your
insurance company?
Yeah, the insurance industry. How would you bring them to account for their mistreatment of physicians? I guess.
So is it with, really that the government is not, you know, adequately providing? Or is Medicare influenced by the insurance companies? What role
does
the insurance?
So here's an actual solution that I think really works that's actually part of the new healthcare reform. People aren't familiar with this, but there's something called direct primary care, and that means that, you know, basically for primary care, which is what 99% of people need on an everyday basis, just regular things like his finger hurts and I'm at the DMV, regular stuff that doesn't cost $1 million, then what you do is you treat that outside of the insurance system. Meeting insurance is really meant for catastrophes. Like you don't call your house insurance when you need your lawn mowed. You don't try to call your car insurance company when you're doing a fill up and try to figure out how they're going to reimburse you for that, or an oil change. You know, really, insurance should be like a risk pool that everyone participates in that protects everyone from catastrophes, and then let the free market go at the local level on simple primary care things. Because literally, you know, if you hired a third party to pay your restaurant bill, you would be paying 40% more, and you'd wait a week for a table and get 10 minutes to eat. So it really doesn't make sense, I think, for primary care. That's my idea. And it's not original with me.
Hi, I'm Lal Kar, Thrive Chiropractic. I'm actually a visitor for my first time to Eugene City Club today, and I'm a delegate from my table of City Club members. And it was a delight to sit down and see some badges supporting the Occupy movement. And as you were speaking, and I was really moved by the climate in medicine, I just wanted to shout out Occupy Healthcare. And so the question from our table is, as your human being, Ness, how do you see us occupying healthcare to change it from the ground up?
Okay, so regarding how we would occupy healthcare, this is just what I think makes the most sense is, you know, everyone has their own methods, but I try to go with the one that I think is going to be the most effective. And so I don't think it would really help, you know, honestly, for me to just sit in a tent and do things that are confrontational or, you know, I mean, there is a role for everything. But I think what I believe is going to be most effective is inspiring people with local solutions. So sort of demonstrating be the change sort of thing rather than confrontation, conflict, or, you know, like tearing other people's ideas down. I think just demonstrating having fun and loving what you do, that naturally attracts people, you know, versus, you know, chanting and protesting. And that's just my method. I like the inspiring method. So, and I think as we go into the paradigm shift here, the inspiring each other method is going to take on more of the predominant mode.
Hi, Randy Prince, City Club member. My table full of your patients, your grateful, appreciative patients. One of our one person raised a very practical issue with Medicare. Of course, we all need to go on Medicare at age 65, and more of the population will be on this system, which has its problems. Well, she pays for Part B for doctor services, and Part D for remedies, prescriptions, and such. But you also mentioned how much people want some of the alternative therapies, whether it's a homeopathic or so on, and most of them are not covered under this. Is there any remedy that the community could take right now in addition to the money they're paying or instead of paying that money to Medicare to access those services that they're telling you they want and that you do incorporate into your practice as current Medicare patients?
I think it would be great if somehow the state of Oregon took a lead and allowed people to get creative with delivery of primary care, either by paying, you know, you could pay, they've discovered that just paying $1 a day, so that's $30 a month, can provide excellent primary care for everyone in the country. You know, your employers pay like 25, 30 times that amount for your insurance. Just leave insurance for catastrophes and then let your local family doctor who you would like to support financially. I mean, doesn't it feel probably better to know that your money is going directly to the doctor instead of through all these other loops? And so I would just suggest that we allow people to get creative with this concept, and then you have more than enough money left over to buy your homeopathics and get an acupuncture treatment, you know, if you don't have to pay multiple $100s per month for premiums for primary care.
Robin Fletcher, I'm a City Club member since 2004, and I have a question. My father was a general practitioner, and way back in the day, he had an idea similar to yours, and he wanted to open a little single, like $10 for a visit kind of clinic, but he couldn't do it because of malpractice fees. He couldn't make it pencil. How do you manage that?
What state was he in?
Oregon.
Oh, really? Oh, well, malpractice insurance is really, really inexpensive in the state of Oregon. So right now, I don't know what it was back then, but I pay like $3,900 a year for malpractice. And that's for working part-time. If I worked full-time, I would pay twice that amount. So you can get malpractice insurance discounts because obviously I'm less of a risk because I'm working part-time. And so so basically, it's very affordable in the state. And another thing I would like to say about malpractice in general is that when you have these relationships with patients and patients actually like you and feel like you're attentive, they don't want to sue you. You know, I went to a malpractice risk workshop one time, and they told a story about a woman who went to an attorney for some bad outcome, and the attorney pulled all her medical records together and gave her a list of 20 doctors that they were going to sue in her case. And he just wanted to make sure she was okay with it before they went to the courthouse. And she read that whole list, and she said, "You can take them all in except for this one." Because that's what people do. You don't want to sue somebody that you like. You don't want to put someone out of business, you know, that you like. And so if we can get back to having these close relationships, that pretty much solves the malpractice crisis for the most part.
Hello, City Club member Diane Conrad. I think everybody loves your model of the community influencing healthcare. What are your thoughts about the community? How could the community influence the education institutions of all the healthcare practitioners, such as medical schools, nursing schools?
Oh, how can they influence the medical education? Well, I think what's happened with just the people in this community who came to the town hall meetings, they would be happy to know that this model is now taught in medical schools and medical residencies. So just by the fact of showing up at a meeting in Eugene and being a civic-minded citizen, you essentially are already having this model taught. I think it goes back to be the change and inspire people. And if you do something that's inspiring, it naturally picks up steam on its own. And so a lot of doctors actually call me from around the country because they learned of what I'm doing through their residency program. And actually, I have about 60 doctors coming to Eugene to be trained on community organizing and how to lead town hall meetings this winter, which I'm teaching for free.
Sandra Bishop, City Club member. We actually had one of our questions was about the insurance that you had to have, so you already covered that. But one of the discussions that we had around our table was that it seems kind of almost warm and fuzzy and wonderful the way you're doing a general practice, but when things get a little more complicated and people have situations so they have a hole in their heart or something that really has to have high-tech kind of interventions, can you talk a little bit about how or are you able to actually, for people with real serious conditions, are you able to actually, how do you access that kind of technology or those kind of systems if you don't have an association with a hospital? Or can you talk a little bit about that?
Okay, so she wants me to talk about what to do with sort of like life-threatening situations and how I would treat that. First of all, I have to say that like old-style family medicine, we pretty much do everything. And so like my first patient came in with a pretty catastrophic condition, and he could have had a stroke any moment from extremely high blood pressure, and he was only 25. And so what I did is I went with him to the hospital and watched his whole angioplasty, and we cleared out his renal artery, and I participated in all of that. Not at the technical part, but he said afterwards, he's like, "You were the last person. Your face was the last one I saw when they put me under, and you're the first one here when I woke up." And you know, that's probably comforting to somebody versus being stuck alone in a place that they don't recognize anyone. And so another thing is that, you know, in my practice, I actually had a man come in with all sorts of nodules on his back, and I took one off, and it was lung cancer. So I actually have diagnosed lung cancer and removed metastatic lung cancer in my little 280 square foot office at Tamarack Wellness Center. You know, Tamarack Building is what it's called now. So the thing is, doctors can do a lot more than they're able to do on this assembly line. You can't in 7 minutes do some of these things that I can do now. I mean, it's sort of like practicing third world style medicine, because I have patients coming to me who haven't seen a doctor in 20 or 30 years because they trust me and they don't trust other allopathic doctors. So it's pretty exciting that way. And as far as, you know, high-tech medicine. I'm not against high-tech. I just think we're underutilizing compassion. We're underutilizing humanity. And so when we do that, we don't really need. In fact, people are not so inclined to get every high-tech test if they feel like their doctor really loves them and is telling them the truth. They will forego all these tests. But if they feel snubbed by their doctor, then they want everything. I want everything my insurance covers, you know, because they're mad. And so again, that goes back to the catastrophic program that would help people in high-tech situations with serious conditions.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. Back to the original question about the need for more doctors in this country and the cost of training them, I was immediately remembering the number of people that are going to Cuba to get free education. How could, if we get health care as a basic human right, and get that through to the congressman, how can we manage to get the doctors paid for in that manner with as a basic human right?
Yeah, I think if we take the financial burden, the noose around their neck that they graduate with. I just met a couple. They're both physicians. They just graduated. They have a combined debt load of $500,000 for medical school. They're not even going to be able to own a house, okay? So your doctor doesn't have enough money to own a house. It's insane. And how we can deal with this is obviously giving them loan repayment or forgiving this debt, especially if they want to do primary care. Boy, that would be a great way to get a lot of primary care physicians. If you want to open a community clinic, if you really want to serve people at, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people that want to go into primary care, but they look at, they have $250,000 of debt. Medicare is only paying 3 cents, and now they're going to get a 27% cut. You know, I mean, it's just human nature. They're going to go into something like ophthalmology or somewhere where they can get three times as much money. And so, yeah, we just have to, I would say we need to value our healers, you know, really value what our primary care doctors are offering us.
Hi, Marty Wilde, City Club member since 2010. I guess I appreciate your point of view regarding insurance being for emergencies, and that model is sort of adopted in the high deductible health plan healthcare model, where you're responsible for the first set amount, and then for catastrophic care, it's covered. The problem is, well, that does tend to make people consider the expenses more, make them more involved in asking the appropriate questions of their physicians. They're also intensely unpopular. That, in fact, there's an article in the paper where the local nurses association, is considering striking because they're being forced onto a plan like that. So, how would you propose to deal with the unpopularity of that that setup where people are responsible for the first set amount of their health care and then they just don't seem to want it?
I think if it's mandated for them and they have to pick choice A or choice B and they feel like it's forced upon them, there's a lot more resistance than if they feel like they came together in a community meeting and they actually decided to do it on their own. So that's the difference, is that people, I'm not dictating anything. I'm just sort of like the megaphone. You know, I'm just listening to what everyone puts together, and then I'm like, oh, okay, I'll do what you guys want. And so when you listen to people who are really a lot smarter than doctors like to think that patients are, when you listen to what they want, they've really got it. They've got it down. And so I think that's why it's so important to go community by community and see, you know, what might work in Eugene might be completely different than what they would want to adopt in Manhattan or on an Indian reservation. You know, cultural differences exist in regions. And so I think not forcing anyone to do anything. And again, you are more likely to want to share what you have with somebody who doesn't have something if you're sitting at the same table with them versus let me send this all the way up to the federal government and cross my fingers and hope it comes back, you know? So.
Yes, John DeLoe, City Club member. And what you were talking about, $1 a day, $3 a month, sounds like the mandate. And that's going before the Supreme Court coming up. And if it's shot down, which I expect it will be, what would you put it in its place?
In place of taking $30 a day to pay for primary care, what I think, again, you can do there's sort of like two methods. You either do like fee for service, or you do you know, a monthly payment sort of thing where everyone pays into a pot. So again, that's something that you could actually, for $30 a month, get a Marcus Welby thing going, you know, because that if everyone paid that much money, doctors would have a salary that's livable, and they would be able to take care of their patient population if everyone agreed that it was worth $30 a month. Versus, you could also do it another way. There are doctors who are, you know, not having a monthly fee, but they're charging for visits like $40, you know, instead of $150 or whatever for a physical. They're charging some reasonable amount, and if everyone agrees to it and pays the doctor directly and they don't have to spend all that time billing insurance and such, it could work in that method. I don't pretend to have all the answers. I'm just saying that I know that as a group, everyone in this room has the answer, and that we could decide this on our own and actually manifest it without waiting for politician saviors, without, you know, without feeling like we're forced to do something that's better for the country or better for the whole state of Oregon. We could actually, at a community level, decide to do something. And it doesn't even have to be the whole community. It could just be a section of the community. There's creative ways of bringing people together and inspiring them to solve their own problems. And it could happen in medicine, education, you know, pretty much any realm. And I think the key question is not focusing on what's not working and reacting to that, but focusing on what is the ideal. Bringing people together and asking, what's your ideal? You know, and when you ask people what their ideal is and you tell them they can have anything, they really want very simple things. So that's the summary.
Thank you for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club discussion on December 9th of healthcare by, of, and for the people. Visit our website, www.cityclubofeugene.org, for upcoming program details and to read our newsletter. We meet next on December 16th here in the Hilton for Resolved for 2012, reduced risks for our young people. So these are our New Year's resolutions. Tony Bigland's going to give us some ideas of things we can resolve to do that would put fewer young people at risk of failure to join our community as healthy, wholesome people. And maybe he'll give us some things we can adopt. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.